and welcome back to Weird on the Rocks. This is a podcast that explores the weird, unusual, strange, and unexplained, all while getting our drink on. I'm your host, Katie. Today's episode is going to be the second and last part of my JonBenet Ramsey series. If you haven't listened to episode 23, part 1, please go and listen to that first so that you have context for today's episode. In part 1, I covered the history of the Ramsey family, and I also discussed the timeline of events for the day of JonBenet's murder and the events that followed. In today's episode, I'm going to be wrapping up the JonBenet case by discussing the odd details that surround her murder, as well as the possible suspects and motives. Like I said in part 1, I know that the JonBenet story has been widely covered and may seem overdone in the true crime community, but I hope that even if you're well-versed on this case, that you'll still find this episode interesting and hopefully learn some new information that maybe you haven't heard elsewhere. I also want to add a trigger warning for this episode because I will be discussing some graphic details, including talk of sexual abuse. This episode is going to be pretty long and very heavy, so please try to listen in a place where you can really focus on the information presented. I really poured my heart and soul into this research, and without the recording or editing, I've spent about 30 hours on this so far, so I hope you enjoy and are able to keep an open mind throughout the episode. If you want to find my show, I'm on Facebook and Instagram at Weird on the Rocks Podcast, Twitter at Weird_Rocks, and the website weirdontherocks.weebly.com. Please subscribe wherever you're listening now and rate and review the show on iTunes. It really helps me out. Before we get into the good stuff, I want to share this week's beverage of choice. Tonight, I am drinking a cocktail called Rudolph's Tipsy Spritzer, which is kind of a silly name. I found it on Pinterest, but it is so good. It has vodka, cranberry juice, lemon juice, and ginger ale. And I garnished it with some fresh cranberries just to make it look more festive. It's so yummy and really refreshing, and it's really pretty to look at. So if you're having a holiday party or just on Christmas night, Christmas Eve, whatever, this would be the perfect drink to make. All right, cheers, and let's get weird. So for today's episode, I'm first going to discuss the various suspects that have been named in this case over the past 22 years. I'm then going to go through all of the details of the case, including analyzing the 911 call, ransom note, and autopsy. And I want you guys to really think critically about what suspect or suspects you think fit best. Honestly, I went into this case thinking I knew everything, and I had a suspect in my mind of who I definitely thought killed JonBenet. However, in my research, I found so much information that I never knew and really isn't talked about much. I have probably changed my mind 10 times since starting this series, and I'm really curious what conclusions you guys will find when presented with the same information. When most people think of this case, their head goes straight to one of two places: the family did it, or there was an intruder. The theory that JonBenet's parents were responsible for her death came out almost immediately because of how odd the 911 call and ransom note were. Then there was the fact that John and Patsy were allowed to freely walk around the crime scene, have friends over, and that John was the one to discover JonBenet's body. The media and the public also heavily criticized the fact that the parents did a televised interview before they even talked to the police, and believed that if their daughter was truly killed by an intruder, that they would be spending all their time working with the police to find the killer, not doing televised interviews. But what would compel John or Patsy to kill their 6-year-old daughter? Most believe that it was actually an accident and that one of the parents killed her and the other helped to cover it up. And most who followed this theory believed that it was actually Patsy who accidentally killed JonBenet. Although Patsy and JonBenet seemed to have a normal, healthy mother-daughter relationship, there were also some stressors between the two of them. Those close to the family recall that Patsy was kind of a stage mom and that she often seemed to be living out her beauty pageant dreams through JonBenet. In fact, a friend of Patsy said that one time while visiting their home, JonBenet showed her her bedroom. When the friend commented on all of her beautiful trophies and awards, JonBenet said something about them actually belonging to her mother. Patsy was incredibly focused on appearances and reputation, but was their aesthetically pleasing lifestyle really that happy and beautiful behind closed doors? Could Patsy have gotten angry with JonBenet about something regarding pageants? There's also the fact that JonBenet was a frequent bedwetter, something that family friends admitted was very frustrating for Patsy. The Ramsays' housekeeper, Linda Hoffman-Pugh, said that changing out the sheets on JonBenet's bed was almost a daily occurrence, and oftentimes she would arrive in the morning to find that Patsy had already stripped the bed for her. Did JonBenet wet the bed and Patsy, tired from a busy Christmas day and frustrated by yet another accident, lose her cool and accidentally kill JonBenet? The housekeeper Linda Hoffman-Pugh was also very vocal about the fact that she believed Patsy Ramsay killed JonBenet. She said, quote, "I think she had multiple personalities. She'd be in a good mood and then she'd be cranky. She got into arguments with JonBenet about wearing a dress or about a friend coming over. I had never seen Patsy so upset," end quote. Also, something interesting to note is that when investigators asked the Ramsays to submit a list of people they considered possible suspects, they provided a list of 168 names. Now, this was viewed very differently by the public depending on what theory you believe. Many believe that this was just John and Patsy being thorough and exhausting all options. They could have been desperate to find out who did this to their daughter and didn't care if they lost some friends along the way. However, some believe that this list was ridiculous and basically named every person they had ever met. Perhaps they created such a long and exhaustive list in the hopes that the investigators would take a lot of time looking into these people and therefore pull the focus and attention away from them. Unfortunately, Patsy Ramsay is no longer around to revisit any of these claims or details because she died in 2006 in Atlanta, Georgia from ovarian cancer. There is also the theory that Patsy didn't kill JonBenet, but that John did. The autopsy report, which I will discuss in detail later, mentioned that JonBenet's vaginal area had some light bruising and trauma that could have been consistent with sexual molestation. Although there is no evidence that John Ramsay ever sexually abused JonBenet, and everyone close to the family says that they had a very normal and healthy relationship, some also believe the theory that John did in fact sexually abuse JonBenet, and that things got out of hand and he accidentally killed her. In fact, there are many articles online that mention that JonBenet not only urinated in her bed at night, but that she often also defecated in her bed. Now, this is much more uncommon, but it is often tied to sexual abuse. Young children who are sexually abused often subconsciously wet or defecate the bed as a way to push a sexual predator away, almost like it's the body's way of trying to protect itself and seem less desirable to the perpetrator. However, this detail about JonBenet defecating in her bed was never confirmed by the family and could also not be true or could have simply been due to a little girl who was having trouble controlling her bodily functions. John Ramsay is now 76. After the death of Patsy Ramsay, John met Beth Holloway, the mother of Natalie Holloway, an American teenager who went missing in Aruba on a school trip in 2005. It is believed the two had a romantic relationship and bonded over the fact that they had both lost their daughters in such tragic and public ways, although this was never confirmed. In 2011, John married his third wife, Jan Rousseau, and the two live in Michigan. Along with John and Patsy Ramsay, there is also another member of the Ramsay family whom many believe to be responsible for JonBenet's death, although he was never actually considered a suspect by the police, her brother Burke Ramsay, who would have been 9 at the time of the murder. Burke was considered to be a quiet child, and the family gardener, Brian Scott, described Burke as introverted and that while JonBenet would often come outside to run around and play in the leaves, Burke would stay inside and keep to himself. We also can't forget the odd behavior behavior and language Burke presented when interviewed after her murder. Many point out that he seems void of any genuine emotion and talks about JonBenet's death in a very casual and callous way. And although this has never been confirmed, many believe that Burke deals with some kind of mental health or behavioral issues. In fact, investigators found many books in the Ramsey home that were about how to deal with and discipline difficult children, including books that covered how to handle children who were showing aggressive sexual behavior. Many believe that JonBenet was indeed being sexually abused in her home, but that it was by Burke and not by her father. Perhaps Burke was abusing JonBenet and things got out of control, or she threatened to tell on him and he decided to kill her. There is also the theory that Burke was not sexually abusive in any way, but was simply just jealous of JonBenet and lost his temper. Maybe the fact that she was outgoing and often the center of attention finally got to him and he killed her in a jealous rage. Or maybe Burke did kill her, but it was all an accident. And it wouldn't be the first time that Burke accidentally hurt his sister. Just the year before, he hit her in the face with a golf club when she got too close to him, resulting in many doctor's appointments and a minor cosmetic surgery for JonBenet. Perhaps Burke and JonBenet were playing with their Christmas toys and there was an accident of some kind. Many who follow this theory believe that John and Patsy helped cover up the accident because they didn't want something bad to happen to Burke too. They had just lost a child, so maybe they did the unthinkable to help protect the only child they had left. In 2016, Burke sat down with Dr. Phil for a televised interview in which he discussed his experience of JonBenet's death. He said that he, quote, doesn't want anybody to stop working on the case. I want them to focus on finding the real killer and not making up bogus theories about me and my parents, end quote. And just as with his interview as a 9-year-old, the public has heavily criticized this interview, pointing out that Burke is smiling the whole time, looks around awkwardly with his eyes, and fidgets. Some believe that these are simply signs of him being uncomfortable, and Dr. Phil himself defends Burke by saying these are just signs of anxiety and being awkward, not creepy, while others believe these are signs of a psychopath and someone detached from real human emotion. Outside of the family, there is also the theory that an intruder entered the home and killed JonBenet, and several suspects have come up in the past 22 years. In the year 2000, the Boulder District Attorney hired homicide detective Lou Smith to conduct an investigation of the case and the Ramsey home. He concluded that he believed an intruder was responsible for killing JonBenet. However, since then, many of his investigative tactics and opinions have been questioned and challenged by other experts. One of the very first intruder suspects was Bill McReynolds, the family friend who had played Santa just a few days before at the Ramsey's Christmas party. In fact, Patsy almost immediately pointed fingers at McReynolds and made it publicly known that she believed he killed her daughter. McReynolds was supposedly very fond of JonBenet and spent a lot of time with her at both that Christmas party and the one the previous year where he had also played Santa. In fact, JonBenet had given him a tube of gold glitter, which he had kept, and took with him into the operating room when he had heart surgery just 6 months before the murder. He was quoted as saying, "The stardust was all I took with me for good luck when I had heart surgery last summer. Her murder was harder on me than my operation. She made a profound change in me. I felt very close to that little girl. I don't really have other children that I have this special relationship with, not even my own children or my own grandchildren. When I die, I'm going to be cremated. I've asked my wife to mix the stardust JonBenet gave me with my ashes. We're going to go up behind the cabin here and have it blow away in the wind," end quote. Another odd detail about Bill McReynolds is that his own 9-year-old daughter had been kidnapped in the 1970s and was found alive. Some believe that perhaps McReynolds had never dealt with the traumatic impact of that experience and therefore projected his own anger onto JonBenet. And after JonBenet's murder, another chilling detail emerged. A few days before Christmas, while at a friend's house, JonBenet told her friend's mother that Santa was coming to see her for a special visit. When the mother asked, "Oh, you mean on Christmas morning when he brings your gifts?" And JonBenet said, "No, a special visit just for me after Christmas." Was it possible that Bill McReynolds came to the Ramsey's home that night dressed as Santa and lured JonBenet down into the basement? Was Bill McReynolds a creepy child molester capable of killing JonBenet, or was he a harmless old man? Some sources I found claimed that both Bill and his wife Janet provided a blood sample to try and match against a drop of blood that was found in JonBenet's underwear, as well as fingerprint and handwriting samples, and they were both cleared as suspects in the crime. However, some sources I found claim that no DNA was ever taken from the McReynolds. Some also speculate that a man of his age in his late 60s who had just had heart surgery wouldn't be physically fit enough to carry out such a gruesome act. The following year after the murder, Bill and Janet moved from Boulder to Cape Cod to distance themselves from the case, and Bill McReynolds died in 2002. Another individual who immediately became a person of interest was the Ramseys' housekeeper, Linda Hoffman Pugh. Linda spent a lot of time in the home and had her own key. And although Linda was very outspoken about the fact she believed Patsy killed JonBenet, Patsy in return voiced her opinion that Linda was a good suspect for the crime. Patsy said that Linda struggled with money and had asked for a loan of $2,000, which Patsy gave to her, and in return, took $200 from each paycheck until it was paid back. If Linda was struggling financially, perhaps she saw John's bonus check for $118,000 on the counter and took it as her opportunity to get some money out of the Ramseys. Also, JonBenet would have known and trusted Linda, so bringing her down into the basement wouldn't have been difficult. Linda Hoffman Pugh also didn't have an alibi for the night of the murder because she said she was asleep in her bed, but that her husband slept on the couch. However, many believe that Linda was only a convenient suspect, but all the evidence against her was speculative at best. If what she wanted was money, killing JonBenet would have completely defeated the purpose of that. Both Linda and her husband provided blood, fingerprint, and handwriting samples and were cleared as suspects. With family members and those close to the family aside, there is also the theory that a complete stranger killed JonBenet. After her murder, the Ramseys were heavily criticized for the fact that they allowed their daughter to participate in pageants where she wore revealing costumes and paraded on a public stage where anyone could see her. The media went crazy with the idea that someone had seen JonBenet in a pageant, became obsessed with her, stalked her, and eventually sexually molested and killed her. In fact, there was a similar situation that occurred after JonBenet's murder in the same town of Boulder, Colorado. A 12-year-old girl and her mother came home. The mother set their home alarm and they went to bed. Soon after, an unidentified man tried to kidnap the girl from her bedroom. She fought back and the man was able to escape. Police believe that he had already been hiding in the house when they got home. And if that isn't bizarre enough, it turns out that this 12-year-old girl was in the same dance class as JonBenet. Could this unknown man have been somehow connected to this dance class and knew both girls or watched them as they danced? Unfortunately, authorities do not know who this man is, so if there was a connection, it most likely will never be revealed. Another man considered as a suspect was Gary Oliva, who was 32 at the time and a registered sex offender living in Boulder. Police were originally tipped off to Oliva when he was apprehended in 2000 and a magazine cutout of JonBenet was found in his backpack. Around this time, a friend of his, Michael Vail, came forward with some information that Oliva had supplied him with. Supposedly, Oliva had called his friend and told him that he had hurt a little girl and needed to tell someone. Michael Vail also told investigators that when he saw a picture of the knot used on the garrote to strangle JonBenet, that his blood ran cold because it was the same type of knot Oliva had used years prior when he tried to strangle his own mother with a phone cord. However, through blood, fingerprint, and handwriting samples from Oliva, he was cleared as a suspect. Gary Oliva is still in trouble with the law and in 2016 was arrested for sexual exploitation of a minor and possession of child pornography. And the last suspect I'm going to discuss is John Mark Carr, a former school teacher. In 2006, Carr randomly confessed to killing JonBenet. A professor from the University of Colorado Boulder, Michael Tracy, was making a documentary about the JonBenet case, and Carr decided to reach out to him via email. In this email, Carr confessed that he killed JonBenet and explained that he had had a sexual obsession with her. Professor Tracy contacted the police, who arrested Carr in Thailand, where he was hiding to evade child pornography charges here in the States. He was flown to Boulder, where he was officially questioned. He remained adamant that he killed JonBenet and even provided his own diary entries where he described killing her and said he loved her and that it was a love game that went wrong. However, blood, fingerprint, and handwriting samples also cleared him as a suspect. And investigators believe he is nothing more than a pedophile who did this to gain some type of fame or notoriety. The last known whereabouts of Carr were in Seattle, where they have legally changed their gender to female and goes by the name Delia Alexis Rake. Now that I have covered the main suspects that have been discussed in the past 22 years, I'm now going to discuss different details from this case one by one and present all of the different information I could find. Now, a lot of the information is contradicting and seems all over the place. Right when a suspect seems to fit the profile, another detail will emerge that will have you questioning everything. I think one of the most frustrating things about this case is that every suspect seems to fit, yet no suspect seems to fit. All at the same time. As I present the information I could find, I want you guys to remain open-minded and just go where the facts take you. If you think you know for sure who killed JonBenet, I just ask that you consider everything, because I think sometimes when it comes to high-profile cases that are very public, we tend to think our opinion is correct and we shut ourselves out from fully absorbing information that might challenge our beliefs. But I think that JonBenet deserves for all of us to be critical about the facts surrounding this case and not just listen to the details that cement our own opinions. I'm going to start with the 911 call made that morning by Patsy Ramsey. If you want to hear me read the entire transcript, please listen to part one, or you can listen to the call on YouTube. On this call, Patsy stopped talking to the dispatcher while the dispatcher called her name several times. Patsy, Patsy, and garbled conversation can be heard in the background. Soon after the murder, the 911 tape was professionally analyzed by the Aerospace Corporation, as well as several government agencies, all of which could not decipher the conversation at the end of the tape. But over the past 22 years, many other experts and the public have continued to analyze the tape and think they can hear things that have previously been missed. It is believed that John Ramsey can be heard saying, "We're not speaking to you." Patsy Ramsey say, "What did you do? Help me, Jesus." And 9-year-old Burke Ramsey saying, "What did you find?" However, the Ramseys always remained adamant that Burke was asleep in his room during this time and did not come out of his room until a few hours later when law enforcement arrived. So why can we hear his voice in the background? In the 2016 CBS documentary, The Case of JonBenet Ramsey, experts sat down with the 911 dispatcher from that day, Kim Archuleta. She explained that from the very beginning of the call, she had a very bad feeling about it. She said that during the call, Patsy sounded out of breath and frantic, but as soon as she thought the call had ended, she quickly switched into a more serious tone, as if the phone call was a show or acting. Kim Archuleta said she remembers hearing at least 2, maybe 3 voices in the background, and that she remembers hearing Patsy say, "Okay, we've called the police, now what?" She explained that she had never been questioned about or asked her professional opinion about the 911 call. She said, quote, "I wanted that case solved. I wanted someone to come talk to me. I wanted somebody to get my testimony when they did the grand jury. Nobody talked to me." End quote. She also recalled that soon after the murder, an investigator came to her home and said that there was a gag order on the case and that she was not allowed to discuss any details until the case went to court, which it never did. She said that was the last time she was ever talked to about the 911 call and that this case has been heavy on her mind and her heart for the past 22 years. In the 911 call Patsy Ramsey made that morning of December 26, 1996, she referred to the ransom note that she had found on their spiral staircase. If you want to hear the ransom note in its entirety, please listen to part one. Now, just like the 911 call, This ransom note has been analyzed by investigators, experts, and the public for the last 22 years, and many odd details about it have surfaced. The first strange thing about this note is the length of it. Most ransom notes in real historical known kidnappings, such as the Lindbergh baby, were only a few sentences long, with only the pertinent information given, such as what the captors wanted and where to meet them. The Ramsey note, however, is 3 pages long, filled with language and details that are completely unneeded and not important, and would have taken around 20 minutes to write, which is a long time if you're a kidnapper who broke into a home and is trying to not draw attention to themselves. Experts who have analyzed the note found that about 75% of it was extraneous or unimportant. And some of that unimportant language included quotes from well-known movies. On page 2 of the note, it says, quote, "If we catch you talking to a stray dog, she dies," end quote, which sounds oddly similar to a quote from the movie Dirty Harry that says, quote, "If you talk to anyone, even if it's a Pekingese on a lamppost, the girl dies," end quote, during a scene about a kidnapped little girl. And in the last paragraph, it says, quote, "Don't try to grow a brain, John," end quote, which would sound familiar if you've seen the movie Speed that says, quote, "Don't attempt to grow a brain," end quote, when a police officer is trying to negotiate with someone driving a bus with a bomb on it. Did the murderer have these famous quotes memorized? Bill McReynolds, who played Santa, his wife Janet was a film critic, so maybe he remembered these quotes from movies they had watched together. Or did John or Patsy Ramsey, both big movie lovers with movie posters adorning their basement walls, take lines from some of their favorite movies? Soon after the murder, when the ransom note was originally analyzed, it was found that the note was written on a notepad from inside the home, one that investigators actually found on the kitchen counter. The pen was a Sharpie, also from inside the home, and found in a pen holder near the telephone. This means that the murderer had to have written the ransom note while inside the home, although it can't be known whether or not the author made up the note while in the home or if they were copying it from a separate piece of paper. Investigators also found a crumpled up wad of the notepad paper in the trash. This piece of paper appeared to be a practice note that was discarded and was addressed to Mr. and Mrs., then a mark that looks like the beginning of a capital R. But the actual ransom note was only addressed to John Ramsey. So why did the murderer change their mind? Some speculate that this practice note addressed to Mr. and Mrs. could have just been a note written by their housekeeper, totally unrelated to the murder, but she never came forward to confirm that. This change in language at the beginning of the letter also brings up the question of why John Ramsey and his family would have been targeted. The ransom note says, quote, "We respect your business, but not the country that it serves," end quote, alluding to the fact that the murderer and the small foreign faction they belong to dislikes the United States. So why not target a politician or a famous person? Was the murder perhaps just actually an act of revenge towards John Ramsey? And instead of directly hurting him, the murderer wanted to hurt someone that he loved instead. Experts who have studied the note have created various profiles for the person whom they believe wrote this note, but their opinions differ greatly. When the note was originally analyzed, it was believed to have been written by a male in his late teens or early 20s. This was because of both the penmanship and language, which the handwriting analysis found to be juvenile, such as beginning the note by saying, "Listen carefully," even though it's a note and you read it, or the mentions of not liking John Ramsey, something that perhaps a younger adult would be more concerned about. However, other experts believe that the author is an adult, 30 years or older, has a high ability of writing, is a native English speaker, and is most likely female. In the first sentence of the note, it states that the author is a member of a small foreign faction, meaning that their first language was most likely not English. The author then proceeds to misspell the words business and possession soon after. However, the only misspellings occur within the first paragraph, and other uncommon and more difficult words, such as attaché and adequate, are spelled properly, with attaché even having the accent mark over the E. Perhaps the author truly did not know how to spell the words business or possession correctly. Or perhaps the author purposely misspelled those words to make it appear as if English wasn't their native language. But as the note went on, they became more relaxed and slipped back into their natural writing style, which was very eloquent and grammatically correct. Experts also believe the author to possibly be female due to some of the more maternalistic type of language used. For instance, the author explains that the delivery of the ransom note will be exhausting and to be well rested, and also tells the Ramses to bring an appropriate sized attaché, which is a French word for briefcase, to hold their money. Why would a murderer be worried about the Ramses' sleep or if they had the correct sized bag? The ransom note has also been compared to writing samples of both John and Patsy Ramsey. While John was immediately ruled out as the author of the note, some handwriting analysts have also ruled out Patsy Ramsey, while some believe that she could be the author of the note. A lot of this belief rests on one simple detail: how Patsy Ramsey wrote her A's. In the ransom note, the author used manuscript-style A's. Writing samples taken by investigators from before the murder showed that Patsy Ramsey also used manuscript-style A's in her handwriting, something that is fairly uncommon, as most people use cursive-style A's. After the murder, investigators asked Patsy to write some new samples, including rewriting the ransom note in its entirety several times, and this time, she used cursive A's. Then, several months later, investigators asked for another handwriting sample, and Patsy's mother provided them with a list of names that Patsy had written that she found near the phone. On this list, Patsy had written a manuscript A, then crossed it out and wrote a cursive A over top. So, what caused the sudden change in Patsy's handwriting? And what, if anything, was she trying to hide? There's also one important detail that might make all of the handwriting analysis obsolete. There were no fingerprints found on the ransom note, meaning that the author most likely wrote it while wearing gloves. However, when suspects in this crime were asked to rewrite the note, none of them were asked to wear gloves. Perhaps the killer wore ill-fitting gloves that could have obstructed their handwriting. Some also speculate that the author could have written the note with their less dominant hand, but no suspects were ever asked to write the note with their other hand. The ransom note also asks for a very specific amount of money, $118,000. This amount of money is odd when it comes to ransom notes, which usually request much larger amounts of money. John Ramsey was a millionaire, so why would the murderer risk being caught to ask for such a small and specific amount of money? Or perhaps the murderer was indeed a young male, and this amount of money was large to them and something to risk their life over. However, although the amount of money seems small in comparison to the Ramsey's net worth, it isn't exactly a random amount. In fact, John Ramsey had recently received a Christmas bonus from his company, Access Graphics, and the amount of that bonus? $118,000. Was this amount of money just a lucky guess? Or did the murderer somehow have insider information and know the amount of John Ramsey's bonus? Was it a subconscious slip by Patsy Ramsey when she was flustered and writing the letter? Or was the murderer an insider who knew John and Patsy and were aware of their financial status? Perhaps a coworker who knew about John's bonus, or a family friend who Patsy had bragged about the bonus to, or the housekeeper who was in their home daily and could have seen his bonus check. And the last strange detail from the ransom letter, and perhaps the most perplexing, is the ending, SBTC Victory. In the 22 years since this crime, no group or organization with the acronym SBTC has ever been identified. One major theory out there is that SBTC stands for Saved by the Cross. John and Patsy were devout Christians, and their faith was a major focus in their life. Many believe that this ending was perhaps a subtle nod to their religion, or their way of justifying JonBenet's death by saying she was saved by the cross and attained victory by finally being back with God. No matter what theory you believe when it comes to this case, most people and experts alike believe that this ransom note was filled with inaccuracies and most likely wasn't consistent with what the actual motive of the crime was. If an intruder, either a stranger or someone close to the family, wrote the note, then the ransom note quite possibly was written simply just to buy time. Maybe time to get out of town, or time to decide what to do with the body. The intruder theory believes that the killer never actually wanted money or had the intention of returning JonBenet. Instead, this was most likely a sexually motivated crime, and killing or molesting JonBenet was the goal, not getting money, and the ransom note was a farce. Many believers of the intruder theory fall into two camps when it comes to the ransom note. Some believe that the ransom note was written first before JonBenet was killed, and that the intruder truly had the intention of kidnapping JonBenet. However, the ransom note was still full of extraneous language and details to purposely throw off the investigation. Others believe that the ransom note was written after JonBenet was killed, and that her death was actually an accident. In this scenario, the killer would have broken into the home and brought JonBenet downstairs to sexually molest her. JonBenet then put up a fight, and the intruder killed her, whether it be accidental or on purpose, and then wrote the ransom note in a panic. If John and Patsy wrote this note together, or Patsy wrote it alone to cover up an accident caused by them or their son, then the ransom note was simply to throw investigators off their tracks. The note added a whole different spin on the crime than if JonBenet was just killed, and caused a distraction and something for law enforcement to spend time analyzing and dissecting, therefore taking the attention off of the family. However, skeptics of the family theory believe that there is no way John and Patsy could have used words such as execute and behead when talking about their young daughter who had just tragically died, and believe that no parent could be capable of that. While others believe that if put in a dire situation like this, John and Patsy absolutely could be capable of such graphic language in order to protect themselves and their family. Along with the odd details connected to the 911 call and the ransom note, there have also been strange things about the timeline of the day of JonBenet's death that have come to surface in the past 22 years. Starting at the beginning of the day, when law enforcement first arrived at the home, Detective Linda Arndt made a note that Patsy was confirmed to be wearing the same clothes as the night before when the family attended a friend's Christmas party. She also appeared to look extremely disheveled and tired, although she claims to have gotten a full night's rest. Friends close to Patsy said she cared a lot about what people thought of her, and she would never be seen in the same outfit back to back. Some have pointed out that she most likely just grabbed the closest thing in a hurry because she was frantic. However, Patsy herself claims that she put on makeup and got dressed before she came downstairs and found the ransom note. Patsy also recalls that Burke stayed in his room this entire time and didn't come out until law enforcement took him to a family friend's house a few hours later. So if Burke was in his room, who was the third voice heard on the 911 call? It is also interesting that after learning of their daughter's kidnapping, that John and Patsy left Burke in his room. Many believe that in this situation, the first instinct would be to go and protect their other child in case the intruder was still in or near the home, and that they would want to keep a close eye on him. While others defend the parents, saying that nobody truly knows how they would react in a situation like this. Another detail that Detective Linda Arndt noticed that day was the fact that John and Patsy didn't seem too concerned with the phone call that was supposed to be coming in from the kidnapper. The ransom note said that they would be calling between 8 and 10 a.m. with delivery instructions, but she said it was like they had completely forgotten about the kidnapping or the ransom. She stayed near the phone during this time while Patsy and John moved around the home with their friends and made no comment when 10 o'clock had come and went. Sometime after this, John Ramsey disappeared for about an hour. When John returned, he said that he went for a little walk and to get their mail. Detective Arndt believed him, although it would later be revealed that this was impossible as the Ramsey home had a mail slot in their front door, so there was no mailbox to walk to. After his return, Detective Arndt also noticed that John's demeanor had changed, and he was extremely nervous and agitated. Detective Arndt called Sergeant Mason at the Boulder Police Department, who suggested she give John supervised busy work. She instructed John and his friend Fleet White to search the home from top to bottom and to look for anything that could have been missed. This is when John Ramsey went straight to the basement, despite Arndt's instruction to start on the third floor and work their way down. John went through the basement and directly to the wine cellar and opened the door. Fleet White recalls that John screamed that he had found JonBenet before he had actually turned on the light. This wine cellar room was very small and extremely dark with no windows, which would have made it virtually impossible for John Ramsey to have seen clearly. Retired FBI agent Ron Walker, who was assigned to the case at the time, stated in an interview that it is common for perpetrators to manipulate a crime scene in a way that makes it possible for them or a friend or family member to find the deceased person instead of law enforcement finding them. John also picked up JonBenet's body, therefore tampering with evidence and contaminating the crime scene, and took her upstairs and placed her on the living room floor in front of the Christmas tree. Many speculate that this was an extremely odd decision and that most parents would probably put their child on a couch, chair, or table, and that laying her on the floor seemed demeaning. Detective Linda Arndt also stated that she believed this was a strategic move by John and that he purposely put her body in a high traffic area where lots of DNA, such as hair, could attach to her body. There is also the detail about the blue suitcase that was found in the basement under the open and broken window. Fleet White remembers seeing this suitcase and broken window when he came down to the basement with John, and John says that the window was open and broken because he had locked himself out of the house a few months ago, but didn't mention anything about the suitcase. Many speculate that this suitcase was either used as a step stool for an intruder or possibly was intended to carry JonBenet's body away in it. In the year 2000, homicide detective Lou Smith was hired by the DA to investigate the case. In his report, Smith said that it was possible for him to fit through the basement window and enter the home, and believed that this was how an intruder got into the house. However, photos and video taken from inside the home on the day of the murder show a good-sized cobweb in the corner of the window that still had debris collected in it, meaning that it had been there for a while. In the 2016 CBS documentary, The Case of JonBenet Ramsey, experts recreated fitting through the basement window and showed that any person who came through the window would have completely wiped out the cobweb in the corner of the windowsill, and also would have brought in some debris and leaves from outside, which were never found inside the home. And the last odd detail from that day that I'm going to discuss is that Patsy changed her story and timeline from the day multiple times over the years. Patsy also gave contradicting answers in regards to what time and order of events things happened that morning. At one point, she said that she called out for John when she saw the ransom note, and another time she said that she immediately began searching and calling for JonBenet. She said that she went to check on Burke immediately, and another time she said it wasn't until after the 911 call that she checked on him. Some believe that these mix-ups are harmless and due to the trauma and grief that she was experiencing, while others believe that these mix-ups are because she's lying and forgetting her previous answers. I'm now going to discuss the autopsy of JonBenet's body and some of the forensic details from the case. Immediately after her murder, JonBenet's body was examined by pathologist John Mayer. The report says that she had green eyes and blonde hair in two ponytails. She was wearing a long-sleeve white shirt with a silver sequin star on it, long underwear and white panties underneath that had little roses on them and said the word Wednesday. And around her neck was a gold necklace that she had received just the day before as a Christmas gift from her aunt. The panties were soaked through with urine. He concluded that there were no drugs or alcohol in her system and that the cause of death was asphyxia by strangulation associated with craniocerebral trauma. JonBenet had abrasions on her cheek, neck, lower left leg, and shoulder, as well as broken blood vessels in her eyes. She had two dark circle-shaped marks on her lower back. She had a white cord wrapped around her wrists and the same type of white cord around her neck. Attached to the white cord around her neck was a broken paintbrush handle, which was confirmed to belong to Patsy Ramsey. The white cord around her neck had left a deep purplish abrasion. There were also some spots of blood found in her panties and light abrasions in the vaginal area, which the pathologist believed to be due to sexual molestation that would have occurred previously to her death. Her bladder was empty, prompting the pathologist to believe that she had wet the bed the night of her death. And in her stomach, he found, quote, fragments of a yellow to light green tan apparent vegetable or fruit material, which may represent pineapple, end quote. So now I'm going to examine this autopsy report in further detail and discuss the theories on what some of these things might mean. One of the things I never knew about this case that really surprised me while I was doing my research was just how extensive JonBenet's injuries really were. I think many have the misconception that she died easily due to some accident and was found looking beautiful and peaceful. However, the autopsy paints a very different picture, one of a little girl who put up a fight. The abrasions found on her body and the fact that her eyes were bloodshot steer many to believe that she did not die peacefully, but actually had a very brutal and gruesome death where she tried to defend herself. The two dark circles on her lower back were originally believed to be from a stun gun that the killer used to subdue JonBenet, therefore making it easier to kill her. But her injuries show that she most definitely was not subdued during her death and that she struggled with her killer. Also, there is great debate on whether or not a stun gun would actually subdue someone. And most, including many police officers, claim that it in fact does the opposite and usually gives a person a boost of adrenaline. Since the original autopsy report, many experts have also pointed out that a stun gun would not leave two perfectly shaped circle marks on someone, but instead leaves bigger marks on the skin that look more like a rash or irritation. After examining photos from the crime scene, many experts, including forensic pathologist Werner Spitz, who worked on the Martin Luther King Jr. and JFK autopsies, saw something near JonBenet's body that could have possibly made these marks: Burke's train set. The train set has metal prongs on the track pieces that runs the electricity through them, and some speculate that JonBenet was actually burned with one of these train track pieces. Could this have been part of a sexual game that the killer was acting out? Did Burke burn her on purpose because they were fighting? Or was this just another accident that happens between siblings, just like when JonBenet was hit in the face with the golf club? John and Patsy, however, never made a public comment about these marks. The eerie realization that JonBenet most likely tried to defend herself against her killer also raises an interesting question that nobody can answer. What happened first, the strangulation or the head injury? And what exactly killed JonBenet for good? Although the question of what happened first might seem irrelevant, it in fact is extremely important and might point towards the killer's motive. When JonBenet was first found by her father and looked over by law enforcement in the home, it appeared that she had died from strangulation from the cord around her neck. The head injury was not apparent at all, and there was no blood present. It wasn't until the autopsy was done that it revealed that she had suffered from a forceful blow to the head as well. So why was there no blood found? The best answer I can find is from forensic pathologist Werner Spitz, who explains that with certain objects and angles, a hit to the head could leave no visible blood due to the elasticity of the skin, especially with a young child. In 2016, he recreated how this might happen. Using a skull covered in pig skin and a wig, they had a 10-year-old boy use a maglite with a rounded edge to hit the skull at the same spot where JonBenet's injury was. The skin over the skull did not break or tear at all, but underneath was a huge skull fracture, almost identical to the one JonBenet experienced. In fact, crime scene photos from the Ramsey home show that there was a maglite sitting on their kitchen counter, one that John Ramsey said was a gift from his oldest son. Some speculate that this very flashlight could have been the murder weapon, and that anybody, including a 10-year-old boy, could have hit JonBenet with the amount of force to kill her. The flashlight was brought into evidence and examined for fingerprints, and none were found on it or its batteries. This was extremely puzzling to investigators because a flashlight and its batteries are pretty much the perfect surface for fingerprints to adhere to. And if it was in the home on the counter in such a heavy traffic area, it would definitely have been touched. And this also leaves the question, if JonBenet died from a hit to the head, why was she also strangled? I'm going to analyze this question from both points of view, with either the head injury happening first or the choking happening first. Many theorize that in fact she was choked first and then hit in the head. There's a theory that the killer was choking her while she was being molested as a sexual game. There are indeed some sick people who get sexual pleasure out of choking others and physically seeing them gasp for air. Perhaps the killer was strangling her, but she was putting up too much of a fight, kicking and hitting, and the killer hit her in the head to calm her down. Many who followed this theory believed that the killer really did in fact want to kidnap JonBenet, but first wanted to molest her in her own home for sexual gratification, then just left her body once she died from the head wound. The head wound would have caused JonBenet to go brain dead, and therefore she wouldn't have been physically able to put up a fight any longer. This theory would explain the defensive wounds on JonBenet. She was being choked, fought her attacker, and then was silenced with the blow to the head. However, there is also the belief that the head injury happened first, and then she was strangled. Perhaps she was hit in the head, either on accident or on purpose, and the killer knew that she was brain dead and was going to die. So they finished the act with the strangulation, almost to ensure that she was really dead before they left. However, this theory would have to mean that some type of physical altercation happened before the head injury because of the defensive wounds found on her. When she was hit in the head, it was with such force that she would have definitely gone brain dead and therefore couldn't have continued to fight off her attacker. But unfortunately, along with so many other strange details in this case, the truth and real order of events may never be revealed. Another puzzling statement found on the autopsy report was the discovery of the fragments of fruit, similar to pineapple, found in her stomach. According to John and Patsy, JonBenet fell asleep on the car ride home and was immediately transferred to her bed. She did not eat or drink anything once she was home, but the autopsy stated that this food would have been consumed shortly before the time of death because it was not digested. So somehow that night, JonBenet ate some pineapple. In fact, in crime scene photos from the day of the murder, a bowl of pineapple in milk and a glass of tea was seen on the kitchen counter. Pineapple and milk was a favorite snack of Burke Ramsey, and the bowl was sitting at Burke's place at the counter where he would always sit. Maybe the intruder made her the snack to make her feel more comfortable. This would definitely have been easy if her killer was someone she knew, such as Bill McReynolds or the housekeeper. The bowl and glass of tea were found to have fingerprints only from Patsy Ramsey and Burke Ramsey, which could mean that Patsy prepared the food for Burke. And if one of them was not the killer but had prepared the food for her, then they most likely were wearing gloves when they did so. Something that Bill McReynolds would be wearing if he was dressed as Santa. Or perhaps JonBenet went to bed and woke up hungry, came downstairs and made herself a snack, something that she had seen her brother eat before. However, only Burke's and Patsy's fingerprints were found on the bowl and the spoon, not JonBenet's. This leads many to speculate that maybe Patsy made the snack for JonBenet when they got home from the Christmas party the night before, which would mean that Patsy and John were both lying about JonBenet going straight to bed. Why would they lie about their daughter being awake and having a snack? And the theory that I found the most popular online was that this bowl of pineapple did belong to Burke, and that this very bowl of pineapple actually began the series of events that would end in JonBenet's death. There is a theory, supported by some experts, that JonBenet and Burke had a fight surrounding this pineapple. JonBenet stole a piece of Burke's snack, and this made him angry, and he grabbed the maglite on the counter and struck her in the head. John and Patsy then helped cover the accident up by staging a kidnapping and ransom, including wiping down that maglite for fingerprints. Even as crazy as this theory sounds, there is definitely a reason that the Ramseys covered up the fact that JonBenet ate pineapple that night, and that they have remained adamant about it for so many years. In a 1997 interview with Burke Ramsey, while doing the same nervous mannerisms he displayed in his 2016 interview with Dr. Phil as a grown man, he was asked what JonBenet's favorite snack was, to which he replied, she didn't really have one, just whatever their mom would put out for them. He said this was often pudding, leftover pizza, or pineapple. The interviewer said that Burke had mentioned pineapple before, to which Burke replied that it was a favorite snack of the family. The interviewer shows Burke a picture, and Burke sits up on his shins and bends over awkwardly to look at the photo. The interviewer asks him to describe the photo, which is a picture of the kitchen counter and the bowl of pineapple. While staring intently at it, Burke says, quote, it's a bowl of, oh, something, end quote, all while he is scratching at his shoulder. When asked again about the pineapple in the 2016 Dr. Phil interview, Dr. Phil asks, quote, did you and she eat pineapple together at any time during the day, end quote, to which Burke replies, quote, maybe, like, I don't remember specifically eating pineapple, but very well could have. Like, would you remember eating pineapple 20 years ago? Like, you know, End quote. Many have criticized this comment, saying that of course you would remember if you ate pineapple with your sister right before she died, while others defend Burke and point out that he was only a child himself, and that our memories aren't always the most accurate during times of trauma. And the last part of the autopsy report I'm going to discuss is the statements about the sexual abuse JonBenet appeared to have endured. In my research, this was probably the area that I found the most discrepancies and differing of opinions. Now, I want to warn my listeners that this information is quite graphic and very hard to hear. However, I want to be thorough and present all of the information I have, even though it may be uncomfortable to hear. The pathologist, John Meyer, stated that there was evidence of what he referred to as chronic molestation, meaning that not only was JonBenet sexually molested the night of her murder, but that it had happened before. He could only confirm that she was also molested a day or two before her murder, but that this could also mean it was an ongoing occurrence. In this case, chronic just means that it was a repeated thing, although it can't be known how many times she was abused. The evidence that led him to this conclusion were the tiny drops of blood found in her underwear, discoloration to the labia majora, as well as inflammation of the vagina and hymen. No seminal fluid was found, and it appears that she was not penetrated by a penis, but could likely have been penetrated by fingers. Many medical experts have examined the autopsy report and photos over the years, including Dr. McCann, an expert in child sexual abuse. His findings were that JonBenet suffered from vaginal trauma on a chronic base, and that her vaginal area was very inflamed, meaning that the tissue wasn't ever able to calm down and heal properly. This history of sexual abuse could also explain the bedwetting and fecal matter found in her underwear. As I stated previously in this episode, this is something common in children who are abused as a subconscious way to push away their abuser. JonBenet's pediatrician, Dr. Buff, claims that JonBenet was a frequent visitor to his office. In fact, she had 27 doctor visits in the 3 years prior to her death, and that he never saw any indications of sexual abuse. He said that she had seen him regarding the golf club injury on her face, for colds and flus, as well as her bedwetting issue. In my research, I found some forums in which people were discussing this part of the case, and many mentioned that some medical experts who have reviewed the autopsy report say that her injuries could have been caused by the bedwetting problem itself, and that the vagina can become inflamed and irritated when sitting in urine for too long. However, I want to make it clear that I could only find anecdotal information about this perspective and could not find the names of any specific doctors that stated this. Some people online state that these unknown experts also claim that her injuries could be from physical activities such as riding a bike or from vigorous wiping of the vaginal area or even an irritant to some soap or bubble bath, which is very common for little girls. There is also the fact that small droplets of blood were found on her underwear. This blood did not belong to JonBenet, her parents, or any of the other suspects. Many believe that finding a match for this blood would lead to the killer. However, forensic scientist Henry Lee claims that this blood could have come from someone other than the killer. Lee proved this in his lab by opening a brand new package of underwear straight from the store and looking at it under a microscope. He was able to find tiny microscopic droplets of blood and DNA, which he believed to be from someone on the manufacturing line in the facility where the underwear was packaged. So could this blood in her underwear have an innocent explanation such as this? Although this seems possible, JonBenet's underwear was not new and had been washed and worn many times, most likely erasing any possible DNA left over from the packaging process. After the medical examination was completed, a forensic exam was also done on JonBenet's body. This is when other foreign DNA was found on two items of her clothing. This DNA was confirmed to be that of an unknown male and did not match John, Patsy, or any of the other suspects that provided DNA samples. This detail made many believe that JonBenet really was in fact killed by an unknown intruder. In fact, former Boulder District Attorney Mary Lacey even wrote a letter stating that the discovery of this, quote, touch DNA, as she called it, completely exonerated both John and Patsy Ramsey. She believed that since this DNA didn't match either of them, they couldn't have been the killer. However, many experts have debated this in the years since, claiming that this touch DNA wasn't necessarily connected to the murder. In fact, when the DNA was tested, it came back as most likely a mixture from 2 to 3 different males. This could easily be explained as coming from someone JonBenet hugged at the Christmas party the night before or brushed past, etc. Many think that the district attorney exonerating the Ramseys based off of this was extremely negligent on her part, and that this DNA can neither convict anyone nor rule anyone out. There are so many theories and rabbit holes out there about this case, but the one thing almost everyone can agree on is the fact that the Boulder Police Department and the district attorney did not handle this case to the best of their ability. In the 22 years since JonBenet's murder, both agencies have been heavily criticized and ridiculed for their mishandling of this case from the very beginning. Of course, there is the fact that the Boulder police allowed the Ramseys and their friends to walk around the home and contaminate the crime scene. They also allowed several people to touch and move JonBenet's body after it was found. And although they were a small police force that usually only dealt with one homicide case a year, they denied help and assistance from the FBI. Many criticized both the police and district attorney for not looking deeper into John and Patsy Ramsey. Even if they didn't commit this murder or have anything to do with it, they didn't push hard enough for answers or information from them. They were allowed to go 4 months before sitting down with investigators for a formal interview, all while they were doing public appearances and talking to the media, possibly forgetting key information that could have helped in the investigation. In 2016, former Boulder Police Department officer Gretchen Smith was interviewed. When asked what she thought about the fear coming from the community in regards to a killer being on the loose, she said that, quote, "The fear inside from the department was not felt because some people thought that they knew who the murderers were. However, we wanted to make the community feel comfortable, so we would do the extra patrols diligently," end quote. She also said, quote, "I think there was not a killer on the loose or some random killer roaming the neighborhood looking for little girls," end quote. She says she believes the media really tried to push the story of the random killer because that's what they were being fed by the district attorney's office. She says the JonBenet case completely destroyed the morale between the Boulder Police Department and caused a big divide between them and the DA's office. She thinks that the Ramseys were not seriously looked at as suspects by the DA because they were wealthy, affluent members of the community, and the DA didn't want to admit that people like this could be guilty of such a heinous crime. She believes they didn't want to actually solve the crime, but wanted it to go away and for people to move on. Former FBI agent assigned to the case, Ron Walker, shared the same sentiment and said, quote, "The philosophy that was kind of laid out for the police department that day was we have to treat them with kid gloves, treat them as victims and not suspects," end quote. He also believes that the police and DA didn't look closely at the Ramseys simply because they were wealthy and affluent members of the community as well. Boulder Detective Steve Thomas also was extremely unhappy with the way the DA handled the case. He explained that the then DA, Alex Hunter, made the investigation as difficult as possible and wouldn't provide the Boulder police with important information and documents such as the Ramseys' credit card history or phone logs. He said that these things were standard protocol in a case like this, but they instead had to do everything on their own. He was also frustrated with the fact that the Ramseys' lawyers and the district attorney worked together to get John and Patsy the questions to the police interview ahead of time, something that completely contradicts the entire reason for an interview. And law enforcement involved with the case weren't the only ones to ridicule how the DA handled this case. John Ramsey's friend, Fleet White, the man who had been in the Ramsey home on the day of JonBenet's murder and was with John when he discovered her body, wrote a 14-page letter addressed to the people of Colorado, which he read live on TV. In this letter, he criticized the DA, the Ramseys' attorneys, and even the Ramseys themselves. He said, quote, "While it is unlikely that the district attorney has been corrupted by Ramsey defense attorneys, it is certain that the district attorney and his prosecutors have been greatly influenced by their metro area district attorney advisors and by defense attorneys' chummy persuasiveness and threats of reprisals for anyone daring to jeopardize the civil rights of their victim clients," end quote. Followed by the quote, "Indeed, the district attorney and the Ramseys' attorneys have simultaneously rebuked the police for focusing their investigation on the Ramseys when in fact police were simply following evidence," End quote. He mentioned the chumminess between the Ramseys and the district attorney on several occasions and stated that he believed the investigation into JonBenet's death had been pushed back multiple times on purpose to serve, quote, the selfish interests of a relatively small number of public servants and wealthy and powerful people, end quote. In his letter, he also brought up the fact that it took the DA, Alex Hunter, almost 18 months to call a grand jury, something that usually takes place within a few months of a crime such as this. In fact, the grand jury itself is a topic that frustrated the public as well as those involved in the case. The grand jury, something kept secret in the state of Colorado, was comprised of 8 women and 4 men, and saw testimony and evidence for over a year. When the grand jury ended, District Attorney Alex Hunter called a press conference and announced that they had disbanded and did not find sufficient evidence to move forward with the case, and they found nothing worthy of pressing charges against any of the suspects. Legally speaking, this was the end of the JonBenet case, and nobody has ever been charged for her murder. However, in 2016, a member of that grand jury came forward anonymously and spoke to ABC News. In this interview, the juror revealed that pretty much everything in the press conference District Attorney Alex Hunter said was false. The grand jury had, in fact, found sufficient evidence to move forward and to indict John and Patsy Ramsey. They believed that although the Ramseys may not have been JonBenet's killer, they should have been at fault for putting her in a dangerous situation that led to her murder. The juror says they have no idea what would have came of this and don't know if John or Patsy would have ever been convicted of anything, but that the DA didn't even let it move forward. He went on live TV and lied to the media and the public and said things that simply weren't true. The consensus among the public and experts appears to be the belief that if the Boulder Police Department and the district attorney both handled this case with more care, attention to detail, and thoroughness, that this case could have possibly been solved. But it seems that at this point, 22 years later, there is little chance that this cold case will ever be solved, and the question of who committed this gruesome murder of 6-year-old JonBenet Ramsey may never be answered. So, who really killed JonBenet? Was it an unknown intruder, someone who had never met JonBenet but knew her from afar? Perhaps someone who had seen her in a pageant or taking her dance class? Or someone who visited the Ramsey home during the Boulder Christmas holiday tour and was drawn to the little girl for a sadistic reason? Maybe it was someone like Gary Oliva or John Carr, or the unknown man who tried to kidnap a 12-year-old girl who attended the same dance class as JonBenet. Or perhaps it was an intruder who knew JonBenet and the Ramsey family, and they used their relationship with her as a way to lure her down into that basement that night. Maybe someone like Bill McReynolds, who had played Santa and met JonBenet on multiple occasions and felt a connection to her. Maybe it was the housekeeper, Linda Hoffman Pugh, who was struggling financially and had a key to the house. Or maybe someone who worked with John Ramsey was aware of his Christmas bonus and wanted revenge on John for a business matter. Or perhaps we don't need to look elsewhere and the real killer was in their home the whole time. Perhaps it was Patsy who hurt JonBenet in a fit of rage after she wet the bed once again. Maybe it was her father, John, who had been sexually molesting her and one night he took things too far. Or maybe it was her brother, Burke, who was dealing with some mental health and behavioral issues and he killed JonBenet out of jealousy or acted out his juvenile sexual desires on her before he was grown enough to understand what he was doing. Or perhaps the entire thing was a sad and tragic accident. A parent who lost their temper and needed help from the other to help them cover up their awful mistake. Or maybe a brother who accidentally hurt his little sister and the parents helped cover it up to protect their only living child. At this point, it seems as though we're left with more questions than answers, and every documentary, podcast, and book seems to have their own opinion on the case, making it difficult to find unbiased information. It seems that every single detail about the case is surrounded by mystery and confusion, drawing us further and further away from a resolution with every year that passes. Will this case ever be solved, and will JonBenet ever get the justice she deserves? I guess we'll just have to wait and see. Okay, so I know this episode is a lot to unpack and is full of heavy information and hard to hear details. This episode was really hard for me to research for lots of reasons. First, there is so much information out there about this case, but unfortunately, a lot of it is contradicting. I feel like every article I read or video I watched had different information or presented their information in a different and often biased way. I would read something that pushed the intruder theory really hard, then the next article I read was all about how Burke Ramsey did it. I really tried my best to include information from every angle and to not just share the details that enforced my own beliefs, because, in fact, I really don't know what I think about this case. Before I started my research, I 100% thought that Burke Ramsey killed his sister. I thought it was some sort of accident and that John and Patsy covered it up. It seems like this is definitely the consensus online right now, especially after the 2016 CBS documentary came out, which supported this theory. I feel like all of a sudden there was an explosion of JonBenet articles and videos and memes online, a lot of them making comments about Burke being her killer like it was a known fact. And I, like a lot of the public, always thought it was an accident. However, after spending around 30 hours on this episode and really getting into the real details, I no longer believe that this was an accident. The media painted a picture of JonBenet dying easily and peacefully, but in reality, the autopsy and photos showed that she died a very brutal and scary death. The injuries found on her just don't support the theory of an accident. I was recently listening to one of my favorite podcasts, True Crime Garage, and they brought up a very good and maybe problematic thought. We, the public, all ate up this theory presented by the media that it was an accident because that's the easiest thing to believe. We can comprehend a brother accidentally killing his sister and his parents helping to cover it up. I mean, what kind of parents wouldn't do everything possible to protect their child, right? We would all do extreme things, even if it meant writing a fake ransom note and fashioning a garrote in order to protect our child who made a mistake. It's easier for us to believe this than to believe that there is someone sick enough out there to break into a home and do this heinous thing to an innocent little girl. When we accept the intruder theory, then we accept that the world is a scary and dangerous place where bad things really happen for no reason to good people. And that is just really hard to live with. But I think that just following a theory that has been fed to us by the media isn't doing JonBenet any justice in trying to find the truth. Even after all this research, I don't have a solid opinion. I feel like every detail can be skewed to fit any of the theories, and that's one reason this case is so frustrating, and honestly, that's probably why it's so popular and interesting for people too. This case truly just makes me feel very sad and angry. Through my research and all the photos I looked at and the videos I watched, in a weird way, I began to feel close to JonBenet like she was a child I knew. I'm a preschool teacher, and I love my job and have created some very meaningful relationships with my children, a lot of which are only 1 year younger than JonBenet. And it just breaks my heart to think of her in her last moments feeling afraid and alone. I would much rather believe that she died peacefully, but she didn't. And it's heartbreaking to think of the fight that she put up until the very end. It's just awful. No child ever deserves any kind of abuse, and especially never deserves to meet a fate like JonBenet did. But I really want to know what you guys think about this case. I always say this, but I really mean it. I want you guys to reach out to me. Please message me, text me, Facebook me, DM me, whatever, and let me know your thoughts. Is there something that you think I missed? Something that you want me to clear up? Is there a detail that really stuck out to you? Is there something I said that struck a chord with you and made you think that it's one person did this and one person only? I want to know who you think that is. I really put my heart and soul into this. I worked really hard on this, and I hope that I was able to do JonBenet some justice and present the information of her death in the best way that I could. So please let me know your opinions on this. I would love to talk more about this. And as always, thank you so much for hanging out with me today and listening. I appreciate every single one of you. And until next time, cheers and stay weird.
That was a Titancast episode.